Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Amy Waldman about her 9/11 novel, The Submission.
The premise is a fictional and entirely anonymous competition to design a memorial for a 9/11-like event.
The Times' Pulitzer Prize-winning art critic, Holland Cotter, discusses the L.A. art scene in the 1960s.
There was no gallery infrastructure. There were very few museums. All the stuff New York had at that time, L.A. didn't have.
And then it's back to school season. We have conversations with authors James Patterson and Rick Riordan. The Times' Patricia Cohen has some interesting new data on public schools. And as always, Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. It will soon be the 10th anniversary of 9/11, and all of us are trying to figure out how to make sense of this traumatic event, and many books are being written. None has attracted the attention of Amy Waldman's novel, The Submission. Amy Waldman's a very distinguished journalist. This is her first book. It's reviewed for us by a very distinguished novelist, Claire Massoud, who calls it a carefully imagined fiction, elegantly written and tightly plotted with darkly comic details. I'm delighted that Amy is here to talk about her novel. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, Amy, we have a novel that really deals with the essential debates about Islam in America following the 9/11 attacks. Set up the premise of this book for us.
Sure. The premise is a fictional and entirely anonymous competition to design a memorial for a 9/11-like event. I say that only because I never use the actual words 9/11 or Ground Zero in the book. And the jury meets. They've narrowed it down to two finalists. They have a fierce debate over which design to pick. They settle on a design called the Garden, and they open the envelope and learn that the winner is a man named Muhammad Khan, who turns out to be an American-born and raised Muslim architect. The jury instantly is thrown into sort of a panic about what to do about this, and then the story leaks, and sort of the city and the country have a similar reaction.
Amy, as you've said, this is very much a novel. There's no specific mention of Ground Zero, no specific mention of the 9/11 attacks. But someone who is mentioned in the book, a real-life person, is the great architect Maya Lin, who designed the very controversial Vietnam Memorial. What are the parallels between her character and yours, your created one?
Well, first of all, she was in many ways the inspiration for the idea for the novel, because it was in talking to a friend about partly about her and that controversy, part of which was her being Asian American, and it was the Vietnam Memorial. That's how I got the idea for the book. I thought, what would the equivalent be for 9/11? And I thought it would be an American Muslim winning, and realized that would actually be an even bigger deal given our post 9/11 politics. And that's how the idea for The Submission was born. I read a lot about her in constructing the novel. And
she was very young. She was a student at the Yale Architecture School.
She was a student at Yale, and that competition was entirely blind and anonymous as well. And the jurors were shocked when they opened the envelope and saw, I think, her Yale station address telling them that she was a student. But I read a lot about her and that process, and she definitely informed a little bit my main character, Muhammad Khan, this architect, just in the sense of, what kind of character does it take to, or personality does it take to design something like this and both channel all this emotion and yet somehow be maybe slightly removed from it? Because you almost need that to be able to figure out what is the memorial that is going to help people heal or work through this kind of tragedy. And also just what it was like for her to go through this, because she grew up in Akron, Ohio, never thought of herself as anything but pure American. And I think to later learn that people were questioning that or using it to challenge her design was quite traumatic for her. So that informed the idea of Mo and what he was going through.
And then another distinguished critic, Michiko Kakutani, writing in the Daily Times, compared your book to Tom Wolfe's classic Bonfire of the Vanities. This then becomes a picture of a lot of turmoil, controversy, and competing agendas in New York and in the country at large. Who's involved in all of this? How does this decision begin to affect people?
Right. So essentially, the novel is told from the perspective of six different characters, and including Claire, who is on the jury, and Muhammad Khan, whose friends call him Mo, who is the architect and the winner. There's the chairman of the jury. There's a young man named Sean who lost his brother in the attack and is agitating around the memorial. There's a journalist for a tabloid. And then there's a widow from Bangladesh who is entirely outside this process. So they are the main characters. But what happens is, as you say, it reverberates through the city and then the entire country. And what I was interested in is both sketching kind of the public controversy and the way this unfolds and things ricochet off each other, but also looking at how these individuals are, their characters, their psychology is both shaping what happens in this controversy, but also how they are actually being changed by this process and kind of this very public pressure as almost a forge that's reshaping their characters.
A number of reviewers, Claire Massoud, our reviewer, included, say that this is really a very close portrait, picture of America, New York in particular, in these past several years. What were the changes you registered before 9/11, in the aftermath, and here we are 10 years into it? What are the big themes and currents you've seen?
Well, I think what interested me, I mean, partly was just the continuing confusion and fear around what Islam is and how do we think about Muslims both universally but even within America, and Muhammad Khan becomes kind of an emblem of that, sort of the fears and suspicions around him and just the confusion about what is this religion, who and what should we be afraid of. So that was one theme.
Well, he's also kind of a flashpoint. I mean, there are hints, anxieties of violence and retribution. I mean, there's humor in the novel, as everyone has noted. But the themes are very serious.
Yeah, no, it's quite serious. And things are complicated when his design, which seems to be this quite beautiful, almost too beautiful for some of the jurors' garden, people start to question whether it's actually an Islamic garden and thus a paradise, meant to be a paradise for martyrs. And so that adds another level of the suspicion. It's not just the man, it's also the symbol and what is he playing with here. And he's a bit of a difficult character himself. He's not willing to go out of his way to assuage the fears around him. And that certainly plays into what happens in the novel as well.
Claire Massoud, and again, others have pointed out, I'll quote her lines, that Waldman's carefully imagined fiction was in the process of becoming fact. What a lot of people are going to remember is the controversy over the Islamic Center that was going to be built near Ground Zero. When you're into a novel like this that you've been working on and thinking through for years, and reality in some sense overtakes you, what does that do to you as a writer? Do you think, well, I got that one right? Or do you think, I've got to do something a little different here?
You think both things. I mean, I definitely thought, wow, I really did get it right. I felt like my novel was coming alive off the page in some sense. And yet, that doesn't matter because you're still worried about what the reader's experience is. And I didn't want the reader to be reading and feeling this is so familiar to me. And so I found that that controversy around the mosque was both inspired some rewriting to move away from it, but also was actually quite helpful to see sort of a template of how these things play out in real life, sort of forged my imagination or pushed it in new directions.
Right. Isn't it helpful, like hugely valuable material for you to have?
Yeah,
to
it was really valuable. I mean, I was 8 months pregnant last summer and went to a rally against the mosque. And just to see that playing out, even though I had already imagined things like that, it was very helpful, actually.
Thanks a lot, Amy.
Thank you.
That's Amy Waldman, whose new novel, The Submission, is reviewed in this week's book review. We New York-centric types think all the big art developments happen here, but they don't. There's a new book. It's called Rebels in Paradise, The Los Angeles Art Scene and the 1960s. It's reviewed for us by The Times' Pulitzer Prize-winning art critic, Holland Cotter, who's here to talk about it. Hi, Holland.
Hello.
All right, L.A. in the 60s. What was happening there?
What was happening there was there were a lot of artists, and there were a few collectors. There was no gallery infrastructure. There were very few museums. All the stuff New York had at that time, LA didn't have. It did have the artists. It did have a few collectors. Those collectors were waiting for somebody to come along and tell them how to spend their money. And that somebody showed up in the person of Walter Hopps, who was born near Pasadena. He was in his 20s. He was an art geek, and he made countless studio visits. That's all he did with his time, and decided he wanted to start something there in LA for the local artists. He ran into one of those artists who was a particularly enterprising one, Ed Keenholz, and they together, I think they ran into each other at a hot dog stand, actually, and they together decided to open a gallery called Ferris Gallery, which would specialize in, Keenholz wanted to specialize in local artists only. Hopps had bigger ambitions for it, but they opened it together. They were not two guys fitted to run a commercial enterprise, however. So a third person came, and that was Irving Blum from New York City, who had already had gallery experience here, and he took over as basically the director of Ferris. And Ferris pulled together a bunch of artists and sort of packaged them in a way that was very different from what was going on in New York. The opposite of angsty New York artists, these guys were beach boys, they were surfers, and that was the story there.
And what was the art itself like? How does it hold up now?
All these guys started out as abstract expressionists, and they quickly developed into something else. They became minimalists in a very special California sort of way. Lots of light, lots of very clean surfaces, almost like surfboard surfaces to their art. Also a pop element. They were doing pop art at the same time Andy Warhol was doing pop art in New York. A guy named Ed Ruscha out there was doing pop art. The art holds up well, some of it. Ed Ruscha is certainly a huge name now. Others are less so, but some of this stuff is doing pretty well.
Holland, was there any kind of reverse influence where this scene in Los Angeles had influences that rippled outward, say, all the way across the country to New York?
I don't think so. I don't think it went in that direction. It came from in the other direction, but not in that direction, at least from these people.
And what about today? What's the art scene like in L.A.?
It's extremely lively. The irony, there's always been a sense of rivalry directed from the West Coast to the East Coast. And there's a balance now where, you know, I think the Los Angeles scene is very lively. The New York scene is too. They're almost comparable. The irony is, of course, that now the whole center of art has shifted away from the United States, and I would say the big art capital today is Beijing.
Holland, in your review, you discuss the approach taken by the author Hunter Drohojowski Philp. I hope I've said her name right. Does she stretch a little bit to make too much of a case for these artists, or is she pretty much getting the story right in your view?
As far as her story goes, she gets it right. I don't think it goes far enough, and I think that's the big problem with the book, because it would have done fine 30 years ago as a history of L.A. art in the 1960s. But in fact, there was a lot of other art going on there that she barely touches on at all, that has become extremely influential, in fact, on the East Coast. And I'm speaking of a bunch of African-American artists who were working in South and South Central Los Angeles at the same time in the 1960s. One of them, David Hammons, is, I would say, one of the most influential American artists in the country today. And she barely mentions these people.
Thanks a lot, Holland.
Sure.
That's Holland Cotter, who this week reviews Rebels in Paradise. The Back to School issue includes reviews of many books, but the fact is there are a lot of kids, boys in particular, who aren't reading much. They're called reluctant readers. And Pamela Paul, the New York Times Book Review's children's editor, had a conversation with two prominent authors of books for children, James Patterson, the mega-selling author of the Maximum Ride series, and Rick Riordan, a former teacher and author of the beloved Percy Jackson series, on this pressing question of getting boys to read.
Why are we talking about boys more? I mean, reluctant reader seems to have become a code word for boys.
Often, you're right. It is a code word for that. I think it's more remarkable to people when they see boys engaged in reading, because stereotypically and statistically, we do have a sense that boys aren't readers. That really hasn't been my experience, though. If you can connect the boy to the right book, then they will become readers.
I think it is a problem, but it's solvable or treatable.
Is it a new thing? I mean, has it always been this way? Is it getting worse?
It probably was a little bit that way. I think one of the big things that's changed, certainly since when I was a kid, when I was growing up, there was much closer male-female in terms of teachers. Mm-hmm. Now it tends to be more females. I think it's harder for people to get boys. Boys are going to be a little more fidgety. They're going to get criticized a little bit more for being fidgety. The kinds of books that they want to read, which are absolutely, you know, my thing about getting kids reading is, one, you got to give them books that they're going to like. They need freedom of choice. They need to be able to pick things that they kind of want to. And they need to be, you need to applaud if they're reading a book of statistics or sports fact. It doesn't matter. The more they read, the better readers they become.
But is there something that's changed? Like, is it video games, or is it something about the influx of technology? Are kids' attention spans shorter?
I think part of it is the classrooms, and part of it is at home. I also feel that it's a parent's responsibility to go out and get books for their kids that their kids are going to love. And a lot of parents don't see that as their job. They think it's going to happen at the school. It might happen at the school, but it's not the kid. It's not the school's job. It's our job. Right. I did it. Rick did it.
Yeah, as a former classroom teacher, we can do some of it in the school system, but it really does have to be so critical at home. And it doesn't really, as James said, you don't really have to worry too much about what they're reading, as long as you build a time into your family life where reading is important. For my family, for many years, we had 6 to 7 o'clock. That was our reading time. I don't care what you're reading, but you're reading. And I'm reading, too. Because if the parents say they're too busy to read, well, of course, the kids are going to feel the same way. So you read as a family, either together or individually. Build that into your family life, and that's probably the best gift you can give to your kids.
There's a terrific program that I think is in thousands of schools. It's called Drop Everything and Read. Mm-hmm. And when a school adopts that, they give over one period a day to everybody reads, the whole class and the teachers. And those schools understand that the most important thing at the end of grade school or middle school is that the kids come out of there as readers.
Do you think, though, that this influx of technology has changed the way what children expect from books? Do kids want faster pacing? Do they want a different kind of reading experience?
I do think that the sense of pacing that we have as a culture, as a media-consuming audience, has changed. I see that very clearly when I look at movies that I saw in the 70s and 80s that I thought were hysterical at the time or incredibly fast-paced, and now they seem so slow to me. I do think that that's true. However, I'm reluctant to demonize technology. I think probably there were parents in the 1930s and 40s saying, oh, the radio today. You know, kids used to read in my day, and now this newfangled radio, and then it was TV,
right.
And then it was, you know, cable, and and then it was video games. I don't think that's the whole problem. I think there have always been distractions.
And you both have sons, right? And in both cases, your sons were a little bit reluctant to become readers as well.
That's true. Both of my sons were reluctant readers. My older son has dyslexia as well, which is why when I wrote Percy Jackson, I made the character dyslexic and sort of tried to turn it around and make it into a strength, that dyslexia was a sign of being a demigod, which my son had no trouble believing.
But that's, How old was he at the time?
He was.
And that his father was God?
I didn't go that far, and I don't think he would have believed it if I tried to. He was probably about 7 when I started writing the series, and now he's 16. So he's grown up with Percy Jackson and really become a reader and has now declared that he wants to be a writer, much to my surprise. And my younger son is the same way. He doesn't have the same learning difficulties, but he's a very picky reader. But boy, the other day he told me, Dad, I can't stand it when I don't have a book. And, you know, you should have seen me smile.
And your son is 13?
He's 13, yeah. He wasn't a big reader, but we knew it. And he's a bright kid, and when he was 8, a little old school, we just said, you're going to read this summer. You don't have to mow the lawn, but you're going to read every day. But we're going to go out and find a lot of books for you that are cool. The first summer it was, do I have to? But by the end of the summer, he had read 5 books that he loved, One of them was Lightning Thief. And his reading skills had improved dramatically. And the second summer, when he was 9, he read To Kill a Mockingbird. So I mean, it just zoomed. You know, there are millions of kids in this country who have never read a book that they loved. And that's really a tragedy.
Do you think part of the problem with getting kids to read, I mean, you talked about, you know, the wrong things sort of being assigned in classrooms, is that we tend to give our kids
serious
books?
Not enough of the right
books?
Things. Nothing. I think there needs to be room for great expectations and some stuff that maybe a lot of kids can relate to more than that. And both. They're both valuable. But I think part of it, even with the more serious, you know, Shakespeare, whatever, get them ready so that they can really appreciate it. Or Shakespeare, I mean, look, you know, set the scene of what happens with those plays. I mean, you're in a rowdy bar, and you're fighting for attention, and the whole cast is standing on the table. So I want all you kids to stand on the table, and I want you to shout as loud as you can, because that was the environment when plays like that were performed. Okay, then kids can get into that, and they can go, okay, I just learned something. Now, let's go through all of the phrases in our language, or some of them, that Shakespeare invented, and the words he invented. He literally invented these words. Wow, holy mackerel. You know, okay, now in like 5 minutes, you've sort of got me a little into Shakespeare, you know.
We now think of a lot of books as children's books, or certainly children's books that children read in school, but they weren't written for children. I mean, children read Jane Austen in school, they read Nathaniel Hawthorne, they read even To Kill a Mockingbird, books that were intended to be for adults. Do you think that that's part of the problem?
I would put it this way, and I've used those books in the classroom, and I've done Shakespeare with 8th graders, and even 7th graders sometimes, and yes, it can be done, but the harder the text is, I would agree, the more you have to set the stage. You have to give them some context, you have to give them some relevance. Why are we doing this? That's one question that I always try to preempt in my class. I want it to be relevant for them. I want it to be very personal for them. So the harder the text is, the more you have to frame it for them and give them tie-ins, give them toeholds, something to hang themselves on. You can't just throw the novel at them.
And a big piece of it still is preparing for that, whether it's 7th grade or 8th grade or 9th grade, that they've read enough, that they've loved enough, that they keep reading, and they get better and better and better and better and better. The more proficient they are, the more you do it, the better you get at it. And you get kids that don't read much, and then all of a sudden, I don't read much, they're not very good readers, or they're terrible readers. And all of a sudden, they're reading a difficult text, then forget about it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you got it.
To see a video of Pamela's conversation with James Patterson and Rick Riordan, go to nytimes.com/books. In keeping with our back-to-school theme, we have a great New York Times reporter and author, Patricia Cohen, here to talk about a story she had in the paper this week. Welcome, Patty.
Hi, Sam. How are you doing?
All right. So these big shots at Harvard or someplace looked at very competitive public high schools in New York to try to figure out whether they really give you a leg up, what the difference is to go there. First of all, what schools do they look at?
Okay. This study I just think is really surprising and is just absolutely counterintuitive to what everyone would expect. They looked at the three most famous selective schools in New York City, Bronx, High School of Science, Stuyvesant, and Brooklyn Tech. And they have very selective examinations.
So in order to be admitted to those schools, you have to pass a very rigorous exam.
Exactly, exactly. And let's say 28,000 or so New York City public school children or from middle school take this exam, and let's say all together in all of these schools, maybe about 8,000 or so get accepted. Mm. And so what these professors did, what they wanted to look at, well, does it make a difference? Let's say you were right on the borderline. You have 1 point below the cutoff. And the kid who is 1 point above the cutoff, he goes to Stuyvesant and you go to a different high school. Is he going to have a better chance of getting into a better college? Is he going to have better SAT scores? Is he going to have a better chance of graduating? And what they found was that it made absolutely no difference. That for students of equal ability, going into high school, you know, graduating from middle school and going in, that it made no difference at all in terms of the scores you got, in terms of the college you went to, and whether you graduated.
This is like a total bombshell.
Exactly.
Because you have generations of kids raised in New York who knew they did not have the financial and, let's be honest, social connections to get into some of these very elite, prestigious private schools. So the idea is, who needs it? I'll go to Stuyvesant and I'm on a faster track still. Are you saying they're saying that's not true?
And not only that, if you think about the unbelievable anxiety and pressure that all of these kids go to, and I will say also that their study is of New York City public schools, but they are extrapolating from those to all selective exam high schools, not only in the country, in the world. They're just saying this is a global issue. This is not just New York City.
Okay, another question that leaps to mind, does this mean – the teachers at these schools aren't particularly better? Or maybe I'm putting all this negatively. Maybe is the story here that if you just go to a kind of okay public school that's in your neighborhood that you're more likely to be admitted to than one of these pressure cooker competitive places, you can get as good an education? Is that what they're saying?
I think one way to look at it is to say the motivated, talented high school student is going to do well no matter where they go. I mean, that to me is the takeaway, that if a kid cares about school, does well in school, is motivated, it doesn't matter what high school they go to, they'll do well. One argument is if you go to Stuyvesant with all of these really smart kids, you may be at the bottom end of your class. Ranked with all these other kids, you may be ranked very low at Stuyvesant.
Right, you're smart, but they're smarter.
Exactly. Whereas if you go to another high school, maybe you're number one or in the top 10. So there's a comparative that says you may look better competitively in another school than you will at Stuyvesant.
So that goes a little bit, Patty, then to college admissions.
Exactly. And the one caveat, I should say, the marginal students that they looked at, those kids right on the borderline, did seem to benefit from the atmosphere of a competitive high school where everybody was very into school and getting enriched courses.
So these are marginal students in the sense that maybe they just barely got admitted
exactly,
to one of these places exactly. that they actually profit from.
And they tended to be boys more than girls, but that's a whole other conversation.
Does this mean when admissions committees at a range of universities and colleges, and we all know kids apply to nowadays in many years, you know, 15 or 20 different colleges, they're not saying, okay, we take this one because he or she went to Stuyvesant, that Stuyvesant or the Bronx High School of Science or Brooklyn Tech, these very famous mm-hmm. public schools with long lineages, you know, Nobel laureates have attended them and all the rest. That alone doesn't carry some weight with admissions?
Well, you have to look at it. Those three schools are among the top high schools in the country to get into the most prestigious colleges, and they do attract the best students. So, yes, in terms of the proportion of kids that they send to the top colleges, those schools have a much higher proportion. It's just saying, though, that if you don't – I mean, I think parents and high school students should be very relieved by this and to say it's not the end of the world. If you don't make the cut, you know, you can do just as well on your scores and getting into college as you would have if you had gone. Now, I should also say I do think, and the authors do point this out, I do believe in enriched education. And so, you know, you have to look at what they're looking at very narrowly is scores. It's not talking about at all perhaps the enriched environment, either intellectually or socially or culturally, that you may profit from that may not manifest itself in an SAT score.
Right. There are other advantages and benefits
exactly.
to attending these schools. Now,
exactly.
have we heard a response from administrators or faculty or parents who are connected with these famous competitive high schools?
Well, you know, I just put this out the other day, and I have gotten a lot of mail from people, but I put it on the arts blog in a kind of weekly blog item, Thinking Cap, so where I do research in progress. And this is a working paper, but this issue is something that a lot of, in fact, somebody just sent me another paper that just came out finding the same thing looking at schools in Boston and New York City that essentially came to the same conclusion.
Patty, this raises an interesting question I'm sure our listeners would like to know about. When you put a hot item like that up on the website of the New York Times, I know you can't quantify it exactly, but what kind of response do you get? How many do the emails start pouring in? And do you feel obligated to reply to any, to some, to all?
Well, it's very funny that you mentioned that, because I really do feel I try to reply to everybody who sends me an email. Now, sometimes the volume is too much and I kind of mean to get to them, or I miss one if I get a lot of emails. But I was actually thinking for next week, we asked people to post a comment. And the wording this week was post a comment or email me. And next week I want to make sure that they just say post a comment on the blog, because I think a lot of people are emailing me and their comments are really interesting. And I wish that they would put them on the blog where everybody could see them and comment on them rather than just to my personal email.
Thanks a lot, Patty.
Thank you.
That's Patricia Cohen, distinguished reporter for the New York Times, who has a very interesting article about public education in New York City this week. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Best Seller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
Well, Jenny, you've kind of jumped into the back-to-school fun this week, so let's continue our thread here. You wrote about First Read programs for incoming college freshmen, how they help drive sales for some titles. First of all, what is a First Read? And second, why does it drive sales?
So these are these programs that many colleges and universities have started where they require everybody in an incoming freshman class, sometimes the entire student body, to read the same book. And then they will often build kind of part of their orientation program around this. This started, according to the publishers I talked to, this started becoming a big deal about 10 or 15 years ago. And the publishers do market very actively to these programs. They make whole separate catalogs, which they use to pitch books they think would be good to the administrators who make the decisions. There can be some real big sales numbers here. Several of the people I talked to said this has been a major factor in the success, the paperback success of some of their titles. I mean, think about it. Some of these big state universities have incoming classes of thousands of students. And, the author will usually come to speak at campus. That's sort of part of the deal. And presumably they collect a nice speaking fee. And then again, these schools often build really interesting programs around the books. For example, up at Cornell, this fall, all the incoming freshmen will be reading E.L. Doctorow's novel Homer and Langley. Remember, this is about the Collier brothers, the infamous pack rats who died earlier in the last century when their Harlem brownstone, basically they died under piles of accumulated stuff they had been collecting. I was interested to learn that up at Cornell, there are going to be so-called Homer lectures based on the novel given by professors, not just of history and literature, but of labor relations, aerospace engineering, and even entomology. The entomologist will not be talking about the roaches that inevitably overran this house. She's going to be talking about another bug, the 1918 influenza epidemic that killed Homer and Langley's parents.
So, all right, you've mentioned one title, the Doctorow novel. What are some of the other titles that tend to work in programs like this? Are there some books, for instance, that are read in several different campuses?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Some of these will get adopted all over the place. And they tend to be stories that take students out into the broader world, usually nonfiction, often will have a public service element, themes of multiculturalism, immigration, coming of age. And, at bigger schools, they also have to think about reading level because you're getting a whole range of students. So you need to have something that's going to be fairly accessible. So some titles have been quite successful over the years is Greg Mortensen's Three Cups of Tea, although with his troubles, I think that one's been dropped by most schools. The Kite Runner has been huge. Tracy Kidder's Mountains Beyond Mountains, which is about the heroic Dr. Paul Farmer and the work he does in Haiti. Warren St. John's book Outcasts United about a soccer team down in I believe it's Georgia, in a small town that's made up entirely of refugees and children of refugees. Catherine Stockett's novel, The Help, is starting to get picked up in various places. It probably helps that the book is now out in paperback. And another book that has done quite well is a book by Mustafa Bayoumi called How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Being Young, an Arab, and America.
you know, often these schools shy away from overt controversy, but they do really want to engage issues of the day.
Now, how specialized are the choices? If you're a publisher in New York, do you look at a particular college, say in the South or say in the Midwest, and say, here's a book for you that you ought to be distributing to your students? Or do the colleges go to them? What's the system here?
Yes. Sometimes, you know, the books schools choose do seem quite tailored to their student body in some way. For example, at Montana State, the incoming freshman will be reading Aaron Ralston's memoir, Between a Rock and a Hard Place. Remember, he's the guy who went out hiking and then had his arm trapped behind a boulder and had to cut it off. We all watched James Franco do that in the movie version. So maybe this is kind of a warning to the students about, you know, to be careful on their weekend adventures. And at Winona State in Minnesota, yes, that is Michelle Bachmann's alma mater. They have adopted a memoir called Packing House Daughter. It's by a woman named Sherry Register, who grew up in a small town, Minnesota, as the daughter of a meat packer, very working class. And then she sort of writes about the conflicts of becoming a PhD. She has a doctorate in Scandinavian languages and literature from the University of Chicago.
Jenny, I understand that this massive first read program has even made allies out of enemies at Duke and the University of North Carolina.
On both campuses, all incoming freshmen will be setting aside their bloody basketball rivalry and reading Jonathan Safran Foer's Vegetarian Manifesto, Eating Animals. It remains to be seen whether they will also set aside their barbecue.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.